Speaking in January 2021, authors Tanya Blackmore and Georgina Parker discussed their book, Community, Palliative Care and COVID-19, published by Class Professional Publishing in September 2020. Tanya Blackmore is a senior lecturer for the School of Health Sciences at the University of Greenwich, where she specialises in palliative and end-of-life care. Georgina Parker is the lead consultant at Heart of Kent Hospice.
I usually work as a senior lecturer at the University of Greenwich, and I predominantly teach student nurses and student paramedics. And I also teach registered healthcare professionals, both on my course and as a master's course. And I'm affectionately known by the students as a death lecturer, which I choose to see as a form of endearment. That's what I'm known as. And this book came about as during the first wave of coronavirus in March, I volunteered as a clinical nurse specialist at the Heart of Kent Hospice. And we started to see patients that had a palliative diagnosis, but were also contracting COVID-19. And if they hadn't contracted COVID-19, it was still part of their thought process. What will happen? Will that affect my preferred place of care? You know, how will this change the care that I'm going to receive? I'd just like to say, if you ever choose to write a book, always choose a publisher that trusts you and you trust them, because that really, really helps. I'm lucky to have that with Clash Publishing. I feel quite privileged to be known by them and work with them. And during my time at Heart of Kent, I was working with Georgina. She's the lead consultant there. And I asked her whether she would contribute to the book. And luckily, she said yes. I do feel sorry for Georgina, because I seem to follow her around. We've worked together in three different jobs now. I've worked, obviously, when I was volunteering. And then when I was working in the acute sector as a Midland clinical nurse specialist, and then for nearly 10 years of work in the hospice in the Weald as well. But I'm sure she hasn't got a restraining order out yet, but hopefully we might get that way. But
it's been a pleasure.
We tend to work quite well and have mutual respect, so I was really, really pleased when she said that she would help me with this book. And we planned the book because we around kind of the mantra or the underpinning philosophy that underpins palliative care, that it should be always a holistic assessment, that we should look at our patients' symptoms and look at them psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, as well as a physiological symptom control. And this was really, really exacerbated and really, really important in the time of COVID-19, because if palliative patients contracted COVID-19 and were taken into the acute sector, it was highly likely that their loved ones and known carers and family couldn't visit, so they'd often have to die by themselves, which is tragic, obviously, for the patients and also for the family. So it was really, really important that if we could achieve preferred place of care and keep these patients at home, that was really, really important. And we hope that this book would go some way to achieving that. So the chapters that I wrote, wrote the advanced care planning. And advanced care planning also became very, very important within the context of COVID. And we had an addition to that, which was treatment escalation plans. And these were assessing our patients on frailty scales and actually talking about ceilings of care if they actually contracted COVID-19 and what they'd want to happen, and agreeing on this to, again, achieve the preferred place of care. Because I think that palliative patients had all of these things in place on the most part, but then COVID-19 kind of confused that. So if they had a palliative diagnosis that was incurable and then got COVID-19 on top, would that affect their preferred place of care? Of course not. They could still stay at home, but we need to sort of reassure clinicians such as GPs and paramedics and community nurses that this was so. So that was really, really important in our role in the community team at Heart of Kent. And part of advanced care planning is having good communication skills. So we wrote about that in the book as well. I looked at some of the breaking bad news frameworks that you can use. And in my experience when teaching students about communication skills, what became really, really apparent is some of the breaking bad news frameworks are really based for the acute sector. They talk about setting the scene, making an appointment. And some of these things are just not applicable to the community setting. You know, if you're a paramedic and you turn up after a 999 call, or you're a community nurse and you've suddenly gone into a house and the patient's deteriorated since the last time you saw them, you can't set a scene or make an appointment. You've got to have that immediate discussion there and then. So I use an acronym called CONNECT, which I use with my students that I developed through my experience of, you know, being very, very old, being, you know, having been a nurse for 30 years, came up with this acronym that I use. And it's about immediately having those difficult conversations. And the students have found it very, very useful. So I put that into the book as well. And then also, how does wearing PPE affect our communication skills? So I looked at the research that was out there, looking at other epidemics such as Ebola, and looking at that and seeing what kind of research had come from that and the advice to take away from that, and included that in the book as well. And the other thing that sort of struck us, and what we were seeing, the distress in our patients, is over bereavement. And we as a society are having to learn to grieve in certain ways. So that's why it was really, really essential to try and achieve preferred place of care, because grieving doesn't start when a patient dies. It starts as part of the deterioration and anticipatory grief. And so if we sent patients to the acute sector, the family wouldn't get that chance. And even if they died at home, we are still having to think about the way that patients and family are grieving because of the restrictions due to COVID, you know, the reduced number of mourners allowed at funerals. And even if a patient dies at home, their extended family may not be allowed to visit at that time because of one household rules. So we have this potential that even when we control the pandemic, that we may have a whole society and a community that have this disenfranchised grief, that they can't, they haven't been able to grieve in the ways that we need to, you know, achieve, you know, getting over losing our loved ones. And so we put something about that in the book as well. And, you know, it's really, really important that we allow our patients to grieve, because they go on otherwise to have something which we call complicated grief, which may in turn lead to a mental health illness. So you're going to see more of that. And that's something we have to be aware of as clinicians when we get a grip of this pandemic. And also, as Leanne said, we put something about professional resilience in there and what actually makes us more robust, and the factors that help us be more professionally resilient. And also the sort of underlying headline of that, if you like, that part of being a good professional is seeking help when we need it. And sometimes that's not always easy, because sometimes the services aren't out there for that. But that is part of being professional, not just sort of bottling it up. So, you know, we are going to see also with defranchised grief, we're also going to see lots of professionals that might go on to have psychological problems as a result of this pandemic. So we have to support each other as clinicians as well. So it's important to add that aspect to the book. As far as the symptom control and patient management section, I handed over to George for that, because she's the expert. She's the lead consultant at the hospice, and she's been working throughout the pandemic with other frontline healthcare professionals. So she was the expert to do that. So I'm going to hand back to George and ask her to talk a bit about the section that she wrote of the book. Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya. So as Tanya said, my name's Georgina Parker, although lots of people call me George, and I'm the lead consultant at Heart of Kent Hospice. I've been a palliative medicine consultant since 2008, and working at Heart of Kent since 2017. It might help to sort of, although we were all there at the time, it might help to sort of remind people of where we were in March, sort of mid-March 2020. when it was becoming evident that the pandemic was spreading and involving the UK, there was increasing amounts of government guidance coming out, not just government guidance coming from all different directions, lots of it in very short space of time. And those of us working in relatively small organisations were having to deal with the same volume of information coming out as those people working in large organisations. We still had to digest the information and process it and be able to adapt it for our own organisations. There was an enormous amount of guidance. Obviously, lots and lots of infection control policies, which we had to consider, as well as other guidance on making workplaces safe for colleagues, as well as all of the advice that was coming out in terms of dealing with the pandemic itself. So amongst that, we were at the hospice, were working to build relationships with local stakeholders, trying to work out who we needed to have partnerships and working relationships with for sort of working through COVID for the benefit of our patients. Working out how on earth we could meet. At that time, this would have felt really quite alien to most of us. This has sort of been amazing as it's developed over the course of the last year. But, you know, I remember having telephone conversations in the middle of March with the medical director at the hospital on with the phone on loudspeaker, keep cutting out because there was no other way of communicating with him when there were a few of us trying to ask him questions and get advice. So things have moved on enormously, and no, I don't think we would have envisaged that we would have had something like this a year later. We were developing symptom control advice for patients, and it took a while for that to become centered and organized, and so lots and lots of advice was coming out from lots and lots of different sources, which was all very, very similar because it was based on sound sort of palliative care advice, but all slightly different, with slightly different tweaks and versions. And it was becoming challenging to keep on top of it, even as someone in the field. But for people for whom palliative care is a very small amount of their job, I cannot imagine how overwhelming it must have been. We all had colleagues off self-isolating, and the threat of the schools closing. So it was an interesting time in the middle of March. So when Tanya suggested this, I thought it was a great idea at the time. I didn't realize quite what the amount of work was going to be. She asked me to do a small contribution for the symptom control bit, because obviously the handbook is much greater than just the patient assessment and the symptom control, as Tanya's already alluded to. But the symptom control and patient assessment has become quite sizable as I kind of thought about it and what needed to be included. But I felt there really was, at the time, I felt there was a need to be able to distill all the advice that we were being given for this very specific patient group, because it is a very specific patient group, the palliative care patients who develop COVID-19, who want to remain in the community. But there was so much advice out there at the time that I really felt it would be helpful to bring it down to something that was easy to read and to action for these patients, so that community colleagues who weren't palliative care specialists could feel confident in managing these patients at home if at all possible, and to stay at home if that's the patient's desire. So I think there were some key points I sort of bore in mind, which was that not all palliative care patients who contracted COVID were necessarily going to die. I think obviously the more frail, the more likely that would happen. But we needed to bear in mind that some of these patients would require symptom control and would potentially make a recovery from the COVID. And that not all symptoms that these patients were experiencing could be put down to COVID. And it was important in the assessment of these patients that the clinicians were able to maintain an awareness of that and try and unpick whether the patient was suffering with symptoms as a result of their underlying palliative diagnosis, or whether it was more to do with the COVID-19. And also I wanted to keep the advice as close to usual practice as possible, because I think there was most chance then that people would feel comfortable using it, but without confusion or risk of error. But also, you know, that the medications would be available, and that it would correlate with most other regional advice that was kind of coming out throughout last summer. So the chapter as it evolved essentially gives some advice about assessing the patient and establishing the sort of underlying cause of the symptoms that they're experiencing, but also thinking about whether there's anything that could be reversible. We never want to assume that there isn't something we could do that may actually reverse a symptom rather than purely palliating it. There's simple symptom control advice, which is in line with the sort of key advice that came out from Royal Colleges and the Association for Palliative Medicine, but is also in itself can be used on its own, but isn't going to contradict other guidance that's been given. And also thinking about advice for medications, bearing in mind medications may be limited because of supply or patients may not have access to injectable medicine. So I wanted to make sure that there was a range of symptom control measures that could be used for these patients. And the basic advice mainly on the NICE guidance, which was coming out at the time, for managing symptoms at the end of life in the community, the BMJ best practice guidance and the Royal College of General Practitioners and the Association for Palliative Medicine guidance, which was all very similar with very subtle differences, but they were the main references that we used to try and give the best symptom control advice. But also it was important that we had some advice within the handbook to remind practitioners that there would be local regional advice. And I think it's been brought home to me when Leanne was saying about the doctor that's reviewed it in Australia, that I don't think when I was writing it, I was thinking it would be used outside the UK. So I'm quite glad I put the caveat in that, you know, refer to your own local regional advice as well in terms of specific symptoms, because that is important. But what's in the handbook is a really good starting place before people manage to get the specialist palliative care advice that these patients may then go on to need. So I'll hand back to Tanya at this point.
Thank you. I just sort of wanted to reinforce the importance of us using the case studies and to thank the contributors to that, because we're very lucky that we had Ashley Stewart and from the CCAM, and also Harriet Evans from the London Ambulance Service gave case studies, as well as Becca Lee, who's a district nurse, and also head of community at Heart of Kent Hospice, Oliver John Tidball, and also clinical nurse specialist Jackie Hackett, that contributed case studies which really underpinned the theory and really, really helped. And I think they're vital to a clinician and understanding the theory and what we're talking about in the main body of the book. So I wanted to thank them very much, and also the fact that, you know, they agreed to give their really valuable time to writing the book as well, and without asking for fees as well. So thank you for that. And it really, really is an integral part of the book, that those case studies. So thank you very much.
Sorry, I forgot to say that, as Georgina said, that the royalties are going to Heart of Kent Hospice, the writing royalties, which is 10% of the books. And sorry, I was meant to hand over to Georgina to tell us a bit about the work of Heart of Kent Hospice. I do apologise.
No, that's fine.
Got carried away.
So the hospice, I know, is enormously grateful to be receiving the royalties from the book and the fees that have been kindly donated by the contributors. And so we thought it might just be nice to say a little bit about the work of the hospice. So for those people who don't know, Heart of Kent Hospice is based in Maidstone in Kent, and we care for patients with terminal illness and their families who live in Maidstone, Tunbridge, Morling and the surrounding villages. We were rated outstanding by the CQC in 2017, and this year is an exciting year because we're celebrating the 30th year of our compassionate care. And so there will be some celebratory things going on throughout 2021. Which is very exciting. So our services are broad. We have an inpatient unit with 10 inpatient beds where we care for patients who have complex symptom control needs, but also patients at the very end of life. We have a community team who offer an advisory service in patients' own homes, the usual place of residence, care homes and nursing homes, as well as a very progressive dementia team who care for patients from diagnosis, which is really quite unique when it comes to specialist palliative care input for patients with dementia. We have a family services team and a living well service who care for patients' psychological and social well-being. And we also have an education department. And one of the things that we're very proud of is that one of the really important things to be doing when it comes to palliative care is educating others so that they can go on and deliver good palliative care to their patients. So we work with partners across Kent and Medway and wider to ensure that the palliative care that's provided to patients and their families, it can be as high quality as possible. And our involvement in research and education is a way of ensuring that that happens. It costs about £4 million a year to run the hospice, and we rely on the generous generosity of our local community to raise about £3 million of that £4 million every year. So anything that the hospice can raise from this little handbook will be fabulous.